do we heal these big rifts in our systems?
I went in with my eyes wide open, ready to learn and listen.
There's no co-designing without co-deciding.
All of these difficult questions are polarities, two options where choosing one or the other is always a mistake.
There is more movement than I think people can see.
Our elders enable us to see further.
Wherever we are in an organisation, we do have the power to contribute to some change.
Seth Godin wrote a lovely little book a couple of years back called The Dip, a little book that teaches you when to quit. And I can still remember reading this on the bus. I was going down Lambton Quay in Wellington. I was working at the Ministry of Justice at the time and trying to figure out, did I want to stay there or not? At one point in the book, said a woodpecker can tap 20 times on 1,000 trees and get nowhere but stay busy. Or he can tap 20,000 times on one tree and get dinner. Now, I've been thinking about that little book recently because I've been trying to decide, along with Colin from Business Lab, what should we do with this podcast? And so I am relieved, but also tinged with a bit of sadness to be announcing that this will be the last interview for the podcast. Maybe ever? Probably ever. I think so.
True.
Yeah. I'm just leaving the door open a crack because I know I've had some people who have contacted me in the past, like the episode with the team from Inspiring Communities for the Make the Move report, where we just thought, this thing needs some more oomph behind it. We need to get it out there more. So there might be some of those situations which happen in the future. But for the most part, this is me winding up the podcast. And you might be wondering why. Well, I think the main reason is that it's achieved the goals that I set out to achieve, which was there was a personal learning and connection goal. So 4 years ago, when I started the podcast, I was in a new area of work, a new place of work. Here in Nelson, we don't have the level of conferences that we might have in Auckland, Wellington, Christchurch. And so this was a way to connect with amazing people in meaningful ways. And the personal learning side of it for me was this deep curiosity about this work that I was doing and really trying to understand how can we push the boundaries a little bit to think differently about what is this job? What's possible? What are we missing out on? I've learned so much from 70-odd conversations that I almost feel like there's this support crew in behind me when I walk into a room now where I can actually draw on some of the insights from the people on this podcast. So that was my selfish goal around the podcast. And then there was a more altruistic goal, which was helping people like you who are doing tough, often undervalued work, trying to shift how your organization works with communities. And the stories that kept me going along the way with this podcast, because it is a lot of work, the stories that kept me going were ones like from Rachel Turner, who's a manager in Auckland Council. And I remember talking to her one day and she said, Paul, I had a terrible day at work recently. I put on one of your podcast episodes on the train or the bus home, and it just completely shifted how I was thinking about the work I was doing. And I felt so much lighter at the end of it. And I just went, oh, yes, that's what it's all about. So those two goals feel in a sense like they've been achieved for me with so many episodes that we've got now. I think there's a wealth of knowledge and inspiration for you to be able to tap into. And I'm sure you haven't listened to every episode. So what's next? Well, for me, I would love to continue podcasting, but I'm not yet sure exactly what I want to focus on or what kind of podcast I want to come next.
I'm going to take a bit of time over summer to just breathe in, breathe out, and see what emerges for me. If you have thoughts, ideas on that, then please flick them through to me. I'd love to hear and even to catch up on a call and throw some thoughts around with you.
One thing I have found over the last couple of years is I want to be further upstream in the conversations about how organizations work with communities. Often I've found in my consulting work with Business Lab, we would be brought in at the last minute to mop things up, or at the last minute once all the important decisions about the nature and quality of the community engagement had already been set. And so I want to get further up that chain and actually be working more with leaders who play a huge role inside their organization, setting the culture, setting the foundations for what that work then ends up looking like. The other thing we want to do with the existing Beyond Consultation episodes is to categorize some of that content. So you can go to the website pages and go, okay, I'm interested in Te Ao Māori Crown relationships. All right, here's 7 episodes where I can learn more. So that it's just a little bit more easy to access some of the gold that is in there. So there we go. That's my little announcement. Little announcement. It's a huge announcement. Absolutely massive. But that's enough fluff and guff from me. Let's get on to today's guest, who is Jade Tang Taylor. She describes herself as a designer, a dreamer, and a doer. And she's the innovation director at Academy X. And I don't know how I just chose one way to describe her, because if there's anything about Jade, it's that she is a multi-potentialite. I like that word, even though it's a bit of a mouthful. It describes someone who has so many skills and interests in so many areas. And for someone like Jade, and I'm probably a bit like this too, the real skill there is the intersection between different disciplines, between different ideas. She has started or been part of the start of a lot of organizations and projects. You can learn more about those on her website, tangtaylor.com. And that really was where our conversation kicked off, with my curiosity about what is it happens for Jade when she thinks about starting something new. And I loved what she shared around leading herself from her heart, not just from her head. And that kind of kicked us into this conversation about how do you care for yourself when you're working to shift a system? And also, you know, what is the heritage that shapes us, and how do our different cultures affect us in our work? For Jade, she identifies with her Chinese, Malaysian, and European heritage. So she's still navigating how that influences her today. The last part of the show, we got into some work around futures-informed practice, which I know is a big part of her work with Academy X. And she shared some practical tools and some an exercise that you can do as well. So stick around to the end for that. I think it will be really helpful for a lot of you as we try to figure out how do we keep our humanity in the midst of this wave of technology that is coming at us right now. So that's probably enough of a teaser for today's episode. I love that this was the final interview for the podcast, because embraces everything that this podcast has become. Two people from different cultures exploring with an optimistic heart the possibilities of how can our institutions better serve the ever-changing needs of the people of Aotearoa New Zealand. So please welcome to the final episode of Beyond Consultation, Jade Tang Taylor.
Kia ora koutou, ko Jade Tukulingoa, ko Tangata Tiriti aho. I whakapapa back to Malaysia and migrated here to Aotearoa, New Zealand when I was 2. And really lucky to have found my tūranga waiwai out in Waitakere, West Auckland, in Onekiritia, where I live with my hubby and my beautiful daughter, who is 6 years old, going on 16, it seems.
Yeah.
We just want to acknowledge the mana whenua from where I'm zooming in from, which is Te Kawara Amaki and Ngāti Whātua Ki Kaipara in the Onekiritia area. And yeah, pretty much grew up out west. You know, I went to Kaston Primary, Kaston Intermediate, Kaston Girls, traveled around the world for a little bit, lived in town for a little bit, and then moved back out west. And it's interesting how this cycle of life tends to happen.
Yeah, I've seen that with a lot of friends. Moving to Whakatū Nelson. Oh, yeah. And then about 6 weeks later, oh, we're pregnant. And okay, yeah, I see what was going on there. I also definitely hear you on the 16, just before this. I went out into the living room. Rose, my 4-year-old's there. I said, Rose, can I help you with lunch? Get some lunch. And she says, no, I can't talk right now. I'm busy. And she's like cutting out something with a piece of paper. Okay.
Love it. Yeah.
No lunch for you.
Too busy for lunch at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah.
zone. She's in the creative zone. So yeah, that's
she is. And I love that you've brought up the creative zone, because Jade, as I was doing my research for this podcast episode, like I do with every guest, I've never come across such a, I don't know what the word is it prolific or prodigious? Or one of those two words? Person. Like, your output in terms of work is unlike anybody I've seen before. And so just before the show started, you showed me your wall of poster up behind you, which is beautifully colorful. Because the number of hats you wear is kind of amazing. How do you manage all of that?
I have an incredibly supportive hubby, to be honest, a really supportive family as well, and friends that have known me for quite a while and know that I love living a full yet fulfilling life. So, yeah, I don't know. I think, I just came back from lunch with a dear friend I hadn't seen for a while, and I just realized I'm kind of wired in this way. I think if I wasn't, I try not to use the word busy anymore, but if I wasn't in this, you know, space of life where life is quite full, I'd probably find something to fill it, which I am trying to retrain or repattern myself to create more spaciousness and honesty. But yeah, definitely more of it, and also trying to learn how to say no, or like not right now, maybe later, to try and create and protect the energy or the white oil a little bit. But I'm just an incredibly insatiably curious person, and I love collaborating with people. Of good people on great projects.
Yeah. What happens to you when you kind of have that spark of there's something that I want to explore? Like, what does that look like for you?
Great question. So in the past it was, oh, this sounds like it'll be fun, and I get to meet people, I get to learn throughout the process. And it used to be a bit more of a cognitive rationale as to why I'd approach a project in a particular way. But more recently, and I think this is really a shift post Phoenix being born, my little girl, it's really feeling into the energy and the wide aura. And when I talk about a new project and idea, I feel a shift of energy internally, an excitement that I can't quite describe.
Where does that show up in your body?
Everywhere. Yeah.
Right.
generally the heart, generally, you know, if I'm talking about it, I'm smiling. There's just a lot of hands waving around, gestures.
So, what's happening right now?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I think just feeling into, moving, not that I'm moving away from the headspace, but leaning into the heart space a bit more.
Yeah. And what do you think it was in, I don't know, your own upbringing or culture, what that made the headspace like primary space for you?
That's a great question. So I think that from a paradigm of worldviews, having come from very strict Malaysian Chinese parents who were never satisfied with an A, they would always question, where's the A plus? There was always an element of constantly needing to achieve or do better, or probably an element, maybe it wasn't intentional, maybe it was, but not always feeling good enough. So feeling like I need to do more, be more, achieve more. And I think kind of have more recently just had enough and just trying to figure out what is enough for me, even though it might not be externally validated. And just really shifting into a bit more of a creative slow space as opposed to a outward oriented achievement place, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it definitely makes sense, and I could identify with that to an extent as well, and certainly have been working myself to try and understand the why behind my own motivations for things. Okay, I'm hustling at 5:35 to try and do this thing while my family is calling me and saying, can you come and help with this? Like, why am I, what's actually going on there that's making me do that? That was yesterday. So that's just top of mind. But what's been helpful for you in kind of learning about your own motivations and how you can almost get ahead of the habit?
So I really love your podcast, and I listened to Louise Mara's podcast, who is a dear friend and informal mentor of mine and a coach I guess, in a past life or in my current life, but, you know,
yeah.
A few months ago, a few years ago. She is just really wonderful and really talking about Wairoa and the spirit and how you show up, whether it be in your personal life or your professional life. So she's definitely really helped. I think also I'm a visual person, so you'll see this very dorky post-it, color-coded post-it wall behind me.
It's a thing of beauty. It is not dorky. Well, maybe a little.
And just being able to visually see all the commitments I have and knowing that each post-it note is a little bit of my energy as well. And yes, I do have a lot of energy and I love being generous with it, but also really mindful that my little girl and my family and extended family also need some of that energy. And I think in the past, I've not necessarily always prioritized them as much as I should. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that kind of helps. I think also I meditate each day in the morning. Sometimes my little girl joins me for that. I do a little like dance exercise. So I realize that there isn't much joy and I used to love dancing and I don't really get much of it anymore. So trying to do a bit more of that. And then weekly I journal. Yeah, just little, I mean, this doesn't always happen.
Yeah,
this is an ideal world, but just having those little habits that I kind of refer to on a regular basis has really helped.
Yeah. The little big interventions that when you add them up, it actually means a lot over the course of a week. Yeah.
Or a year or a lifetime. Yeah.
Mm. Oh, interesting. Okay.
How do you do it? How do you do it, Paul? I'm really curious as to what your...
Well, it's cool that you mentioned Louise because I work with one of her teammates, Tui Williams. So she's been, I don't know what to call her, a coach or a supervisor or something like that, helping me to understand connection or disconnection between what's going on in my body and what's going on in my mind and what's going on in my spirit and learning thought patterns that I didn't even realize I had and then how they show up and then so trying to understand, okay, so there's this stress in my chest. Well, that's a signal. So I actually have to stop and slow down. So there's been a lot of retraining. And then, yeah, like you, I've got things that I try to put into the workday to get ahead of that. So I do something called the 5-3-1-1 before I start it.
Oh, 5-3-1-1.
It's super short. And so I'll do that in the morning. And then also after lunch, it's 5 big breaths in. And then the 3 is think of 3 things that I'm grateful for. And that can be often I seem to be grateful for my house or I'm grateful for breathing, you know, like, whatever, or sometimes I'm just grateful to not have a cold. Mm-hmm. And then the first one is smiling, like a Cheshire cat, super cheesy grin for 10 to 15 seconds. And you feel really weird doing it, but it just brings on oxytocin, the happiness drug. And then the final one of the 5-3-1-1 is giving myself a word for how I want to show up in the day. So my word this morning was patience. Because yesterday I was getting impatient with myself and things aren't going fast enough and I'm not making enough progress. That was all the chat that was going on in my head. So today I was like, I need an antidote to that, patience. So that one helps me a lot.
I love that, 5-3-1-1. I'm going to remember that. Do you also do it at 5:31 a.m.? Like, how does it work?
Hell no. Hopefully fast asleep at 5:31. Oh. We've just got our 2 kids sleeping through the night, so I'm trying to make the most of that.
Definitely. Yeah. That's the win right there. Those are 3 things to be grateful for right there.
Yeah. And I'd love to ask you as well, you mentioned about your Malaysian Chinese heritage and also, you know, how your parents have kind of shaped you with their expectations and hopes for you. And obviously you're a mother of a 6-year-old now. So how is that culture kind of growing, shifting, morphing as you know, have a small child to
nurture?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think I always appreciated it as much as I should have. I think when you migrate here, the little 2-year-old into predominantly a Western mindset and worldview, you tend to want to assimilate. You know, you don't want to always be different. And so I would say throughout most of my schooling year, I describe and still sometimes do myself as a banana. So like yellow on the outside, white on the inside. And you can laugh about it. You know, I laugh with people around that. And I think if you can't laugh at yourself, then who can you laugh at, really? Yeah, try not to take yourself or life too seriously. But yeah, I think for a long time, I tend to try to assimilate. And I often in circles where I'm sometimes the only woman, sometimes the only person of color. And it wasn't until Phoenix, my little girl was born, or during that time, where something started to shift in me and I really wanted to lean more into my ethnic diversity side, or learning a bit more about my culture, where I come from and what that means for me, but what that might mean for her as well. So her dad's British, born in the UK, but grew up in Waimate out in the South Island.
Wallaby country.
Yeah, he calls it Waimate, but it's Waimate. Yeah. And so she is mixed culture, right? So she's half Chinese, half European, and just trying to understand encourage her pride around the Chinese side, which seems to be working so far with how that goes. And yeah, so essentially she was a big shift in terms of me realizing the cultural element and how precious that is. And then I started moving into governance roles kind of almost by accident, where I was the ethnic diversity voice and local kind of community organizations, whether it be on regional advisory panels for local councils or whether it be on ministerial panels at a national level. So I was often the, I don't want to say token, but ethnic diversity voice. And I would always preface that, you know, I can't speak on behalf of 100 plus ethnicities and 160 different languages. This is my own lived experience that I'm bringing to the table. So,
yeah. And I think for a lot of people listening, they might be interested to hear your perspective on what is helpful when you come into a space with some of the expectations that go with that.
In terms of acknowledging your ethnic heritage or?
So you're coming onto a new governance board and they've been deliberately looking around going, we need to hear more from people of different ethnicities. We need a diverse board. What's helpful when you come into those different situations to make it feel like a good space for you to be able to contribute?
That's a great question. I think the chair often sets the tone and the energy of a boardroom. And I've been really lucky enough to be on really supportive board spaces, governance spaces, where they've really been, you know, there's a wahine Māori kind of as chair, there's a strong Pacific woman on the board, there are a whole bunch of other more, you know, Pākehā of different backgrounds as well. And there's also a man on that board too. So I'm just thinking about that as an example. And she's able to interweave te ao Māori and different worldviews really seamlessly. Her name's Osi Haupapa, incredible wahine toa. Really incredibly well within, I guess, a Westminster colonial construct of a government, right? But she's does it incredibly seamlessly. When I'm co-chairing a role, or I guess in different roles, I always try and encourage them to widen inclusion. So if we're developing some sort of an action plan or we're developing a new strategy, how might we get other voices influencing our strategy or our direction without, like, essentially asking who's not in the room, who else do we need to be hearing from? And I think that's the design, you know, aspect kind of playing into that.
Yeah. And your kind of formal study was initially in design. What was it that drew you to design?
Well, you know, it always stems back to parents and childhood, doesn't it? But essentially, and traditionally in Malaysia, like in Chinese household, your parents tend to decide. They tend to pay for your education, so they tend to decide what you do. And because I love talking and talking to people, they thought I was going to be a lawyer of all things. And they bought me an apartment right next to law school, thinking that I would go to law school.
Right.
But then I was lucky enough to get a scholarship to study. So I grew up in a low socioeconomic community in a low decile school, and I was lucky enough to get a vice chancellor scholarship, which meant I got to choose because they didn't pay.
Yeah.
So I always loved art and design. My most influential art teacher was Miss McNamara, and she used to let us, you know, hang out in the art room after school, play music, create things. And I was like, I want to do this for the rest of my life. How do I do that? And so, yeah, I chose a Bachelor of Design at AUT. And my career has been very much a squiggly line, but tends to be around design for social impacts, for social change, or for systems change in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I think that's how I first came across your name was through Design for Social Innovation, the conference.
Oh, yes.
Festival or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, part of what I know we were keen to explore on the show is your own kind of progression from learning design thinking at university and then coming across systems thinking and futures thinking. And then it's how do we kind of mash these different things together? So what's your current exploration around that?
Yeah, great question. I think I'm still in the process of learning and unlearning and relearning all of those things.
Yeah.
So yes, initially I did start out as a graphic designer, and then I kind of moved into digital design, and then I ran my own design agency for a while, focused on social change, Curative, which still exists today and doing wonderful, amazing work. So then moving into academia, philanthropy, and I guess more recently consulting, and now I do part-time academia, part-time consulting. I think with design thinking, it's really great if you're working within the team and if the output is more product or program oriented, but really wanting to shift the mindsets essentially, and really understanding the broader ecosystem in which you're designing in to try and figure out where those leverage points are. But I guess more recently, as my role at Tech Futures Lab or Academy EX, I'm really thinking about what emerging technology or what futures thinking might be coming at us at an incredibly fast pace to really shift some of our quite and complex social problems as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's definitely evolved, and it's evolved, as I mentioned before, always learning, always unlearning, always relearning. But what I found was design thinking, and I guess the social change, social impact space, was they're often quite siloed interventions and, you know, wonderful prototypes, but often they would stay as prototypes. And where were the learnings from that? How do you scale that? And I found that really challenging to scale. And then I guess my curiosity around tech and emerging tech and what that looked like to be able to support some of that scaling. Again, still exploring what that looked like, but I think it's a really fascinating intersection of design thinking, systems thinking, and futures thinking.
Yeah.
Kind of moving forward, what we need
to
solve some of these complex problems.
And yeah, you talk about, well, I'm just learning and I'm unlearning. I mean, humanity is doing that. So, yeah, we've got this ginormous experiment on top of experiment on top of an experiment trying to figure out, what do we want this AI to be? And at the moment, a lot of people are kind of scratching their head going, and not understanding why we're doing it almost. And then trying to figure out, well, how do we respond to it? Do we try and put restrictions and limits around it so that it can be safe and ethical? Or do we just let it go and then kind of run with it or run behind it? I mean, what are you seeing and learning in your work in that context?
Yeah, so interesting. I think the White House has pulled together a lot of the top CEOs of the biggest AI companies at the moment. And Sam Altman, who's the CEO of OpenAI, was just being incredibly honest around the challenges, the potential challenges that could be coming if we don't regulate this in some way, shape, or form. I was speaking on a panel discussion maybe about a month ago next to a ChatGPT powered AI bot, essentially. And they asked the chat, this bot, the same questions that they asked the panel speakers.
Right.
There was a professor, there was a cybersecurity person, and there was myself. And essentially, we would all say slightly, same but slightly different things based on our perspectives that we were bringing to the table. But the bot, essentially summarized everything. And they had pre-recorded the bot before they even asked us any of these questions.
Wow.
So it's quite scary, but also incredibly fascinating at the same time. I tend to be someone that follows my curiosity and I want to understand and I want to learn. And so that's definitely the space I'm in. But one of the questions that came up from the audience was, what are the skills that we really need for the future, whether it be the future of work, the future jobs, or just, you know, the future in general? And I think as our world is rapidly changing and evolving, and as the pace of technological change is growing at an exponential rate, the most important skills, I believe, is how to remember how to be deeply human. Mm. So, you know, an AI bot can't show you how to love, can't help, you know, support you when you're, well, I don't know if it can support you when you're grieving, but can't grieve the same way that you can. Yeah, I think those deeply human skills are going to be more and more necessary moving into the future.
Yeah, and not just skills, but experiences. Last week, I think I was on LinkedIn and I saw a bunch of posts about ChatGPT. And then half an hour later, you know, I was picking up the kids from kindy and we've got a cargo bike. So, and then we take the dog off. So we've got two kids on the back and we've got a dog on the front and we're hooting around. We're having a great time. And, you know, I just came home and my reflection was ChatGPT can't do that, right? So we've always got this human experience that AI can never have. So how do we keep that when also so many of our jobs are going to be changing so significantly? And I was talking to Anya Satchinand this morning.
Yeah, recently. Great.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You'd know her. Former
yes,
CEO.
We had breakfast a couple of weeks ago. Yeah.
Ah, awesome. For people listening, she's former CEO of Leadership NZ. She has former CEO of Arataohi.
Mm-hmm.
She's amazing. And yeah, she was asking that same question. How do we keep our humanity in the midst of all of this, particularly in a work context? How do we keep our humanity? What are your thoughts on that? Very small question.
Great question, Anya.
Yeah, she's throwing us in it.
I don't know if I have the answers to that. I think we all need to collectively find the answer and have the hard and courageous conversation together. One of the other questions that came out from the audience was, you know, to be honest, AI has been taking blue collar jobs for a while. Now with the advent of ChatGPT and other generative AI tools, it's now impacting more white collar jobs. So that's why you're seeing it much more in the media and on LinkedIn, and, you know, people up in arms about it.
The narrative for a while was, oh, it's taking the blue collar jobs, but it's okay because it's going to shift us all into more higher satisfaction and better paying jobs. And now it was a false argument to begin with and an elitist argument. And now, yeah, it's just been shown for what it is. So sorry, I interrupted you there. You were in flow.
No, that's completely, just want to echo that as well. And one of the audience members were saying, you know, yes, it frees you up to more creative things or more complex problem solving, but not everyone is like you and me, Paul. You know, not everyone wants to be creative or solve really complex problems. Actually, some people are really happy with data entry roles. And who's to say something's menial to someone versus it actually could be incredibly meaningful to them? So again, I don't have the answers, but I think we need to create a safe space to have an open, honest kind of conversation about this, both at a national level and a global level. It is happening at speed and at pace right now. Yeah.
The thing I'm aware of is there are also a lot of people who have no idea about this sort of stuff. A friend of mine, you know, asked his coaching clients, oh, who's interested in me doing a little course on how to use ChatGPT in your business?
Mm-hmm.
And sort of 70 or 80% of them, their response was, what's ChatGPT? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you and I might be in these little bubbles going, this thing is amazing, wow, what on earth? But a lot of people have no idea what's coming. So I'm interested in also, how do we have that conversation and involve all sorts of people in that so that it's not just the elites making it, those decisions around that. But also it feels very out of our hands to a certain extent as well.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of focusing on what you can control as opposed to worrying about all the other things that you might not be able to. Maybe a couple of weeks ago now, I had a conversation with our CEO, Francis Valentine, who runs these quarterly briefings around digital intelligence. And, you know, the focus was around AI. And, you know, generally both her and I are very much tech optimists, but we're almost kind of moving into this area of tech, kind of just approaching it with a little bit more caution than we would usually do, or maybe what we have been used to in the past. And then I jumped onto a call straight after my call with her was DECA, which is the Digital Equity Coalition Aotearoa, which is just, again, like you said, quite a stark experience where some people don't even have access to digital devices or the internet to be able to get onto something like ChatGPT. And yeah, again, no answers per se, but I think we do need to widen the conversation and widen inclusion around this conversation, what this means for the future of our society.
Yeah. You're reminding me of a conference I attended a couple of years ago. It was run by Internet New Zealand. It was really great. It was here in Nelson. They kind of toured it around the country. And part of the conversation there was, how do we have more safety and ethics around online tools? And someone in the audience stood up and said, well, I think we need to shift from Google to Microsoft, because Microsoft has got much better privacy security settings. And I was just like, at the time I was working at Literacy Aotearoa, and so my head was totally in the stats around, I think it's about 30 to 35% of New Zealanders have low or very low tech literacy skills. So, you know, like we'd have people would come in, you put a laptop computer and a mouse in front of them, and they're like holding their hand over the mouse like it's going to bite their finger. It's just completely foreign to them. So I don't know. I always have that. I can view this one man in particular. I always have him in mind in these conversations of, well, what's it going to mean for him, and how do we involve him in some of the decision making around this?
Yeah. Great question.
Yeah. And it's a very open-ended question, that one. And I wonder if I'd like to move us back to something that you mentioned before, which was this idea of futures thinking, because you're in Academy X and you're in this innovation lead role. And I'm intrigued by futures thinking. And, you know, a lot of people probably don't know where to start with that.
Mm-hmm.
And often when we're doing thinking processes, like a strategy development process or whatever we might call it, visioning work, we look to the past and then we kind of extrapolate from there. So we go, oh, well, in the last couple of years, we've been able to do this sort of stuff. So then that's your reference point for moving forward. Whereas I'm presuming futures thinking is, okay, let's actually just try to look at the future and understand what on earth might be coming that we can't even anticipate right now. So getting to my question now, how can people dip their toes in the water of futures thinking and apply it into their work?
Yeah, great question. I tend to use the futures code. Have you come across that?
No, the what? The futures code?
Futures code, yeah. The futures code. Essentially, it talks about that the futures is multiple, is not just one future. Mm-hmm. Whereas foresight often, so like strategic foresight and futures. So a lot of people like to think that you can predict the future based on things that you, as you mentioned, things that you've done in the past, where are you at now, and what predicted futures could you have? So I guess they're more, that's more your foresight. Whereas the futures cone talks about that there's multiple futures, where there's, you know, preposterous futures, which is impossible, things will never happen. What are possible futures? So what might happen? Plausible futures, current knowledge, what could happen? Often that's where your foresight is. The projected future, kind of the default as well, business as usual, as in terms of if you carry on doing the same thing over and over again, this is where you'd probably go. Probable futures, so current trends and emerging trends, things like ChatGPT or AI, what might likely happen, near future, and then preferable futures, which is really where we want to get to. So what do we want to happen? What should happen? These are based on our values as well. So there's lots of potential areas. And then I tend to walk people through, you know, this cone of plausibility and the futures cone. but really a simple exercise around future visioning and backcasting. So where do they want to be? We tend to, if I'm running strategy sessions, move around the 3 to 5 year cycle. I wish we could think longer than that, like 50 years or 100 years, but here we are at this moment in time. What the current state is, and then what are some like 3 key milestones to kind of get them there. This usually helps people kind of get a grasp of what the future might look like. I tend to paint a picture as well in terms of like what's happening now.
So it's out of date because you wrote it last week. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Yes.
Exactly. So what's happening right now, what could happen in the future, and then actually what do we want to happen? So this is actually with a whole bunch of GCs, general counsel, lawyer types, and how AI and ChatGPT might affect their future. But yeah, I really love the futures cone or futures thinking and foresight and futures. Again, still learning and unlearning what that space looks like can be quite head heavy.
Yes.
And cognitive and academic. And I'm trying to shift it into a bit more of an embodied sense. Like, what is a future that feels good? And what does that look like and feel like in our body?
I'm interested on why it's important to make that distinction about multiple possible futures.
Versus a singular future?
Yeah, most of us default to there's a future and we're kind of working towards it. Why is it so important to say that there are multiple possible futures that could happen?
Well, I think depending on what course of action you decide to take today can end up in lots of different futures.
Yeah.
The future is, I don't think that the future is one. I think it is multiple, and it depends on whether you're designing it for yourself, whether you're co-creating it with others, whether we're having this conversation at a societal level around what AI looks like and how it impacts our work and our life. Like, so many possible potential futures.
Yeah. Okay. And so it gives me more agency then in the moment because it says you can actually impact this. Yeah.
Mm, definitely. Mm. Yeah.
And it's interesting as well, that point you make around the time frame. Like, what are we thinking of when we're, how are we framing this for ourselves? And I've heard Frances Valentine speak, and I remember her saying, well, there's either a 50 to 100 year time frame, and that's helpful to look to, or there's a 6 to 12 month time frame. Mm-hmm. And actually, if you're doing the 2 to 5 years, well, you know, so much is going to change that you can't predict in that time. So it's maybe not as helpful as it used to be even 10 years ago, which is interesting. It probably depends a bit on your context and how much your current context has been impacted on by technology, I suspect.
Yeah, I would say that Frances is probably shortening that time frame to 3 to 6 months now.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't mean to rave about another podcast on a podcast.
Oh, no, do.
I've been obsessed with this podcast called the Long Time Academy podcast. I don't know if you've come across it.
No.
Oh, it's amazing. It talks about essentially what are the sacrifices we need to make today to ensure that we have a thriving world 100 years from now. So it talks about time as a spectrum and how we got to now. It talks about the new economic models that we need to embody, or the world needs to. It talks about future tense politics and why we always have short-term political cycles. It talks about decolonizing the future and, you know, in Indigenous cultures, they already think 7 generations past and 7 generations ahead. And it really, it has a climate and a systems thinking undertone, but it's just really beautiful. It's incredibly well-crafted as well. So highly recommend Long Time Academy.
Awesome. We'll include that in the show note. And it's reminding me of the process I was part of here in Te Tauihu, the top of the South, called Te Tauihu Intergenerational Strategy, which happened a couple of years ago, and it was led by Whakatū Incorporation, the local iwi incorporation. Mm. And the vision that came out of that was Tupuna Pono, which kind of means to be a good ancestor. And that vision has stuck around for a lot of people locally. And, you know, I've taken it on as the vision of the Learning Lab, and I know other people have taken it on in their own work as well, of that framing of how do I be a good ancestor to my future kids and their kids and their kids and so on. And, yeah, I find that a helpful lens for decision making now.
Yeah.
Well, we're mentioning time, and time is a wonderful, flexible thing, Jade. And I think we're coming to the end of our time together. So that absolutely zoomed by. And yeah, I'm wondering if there are any final thoughts you'd like to leave with people, or any final topics you were hoping to chat about.
I'm sure we can talk for a whole nother hour, but I just really appreciate you sharing your time and your energy with me over the past wee while, and look forward to learning more about the Learning Lab as well. And I don't know, would love to connect with people online. I always love a cup of coffee, or, you know, a little bit of a long lunch as well. I think we're at a time of transition. This is something I've been saying for a while, but how we live in this world doesn't seem to be sustainable for the planet, nor for ourselves as individuals. So how might we learn and unlearn and relearn ways that are more sustainable, but actually moving beyond sustainability and what's more regenerative for us? So, and how do we show up in that space? Which I'm still learning about. Definitely not an expert.
Yeah. I hear you on that. And I think for a lot of people, like, fear comes up when they start to get into those conversations, or when they really start to dive deep. And, you know, the other side of fear is hope. And actually, if we can change some of those things, then it will be better for all of us. So, yeah. Awesome. Hey, well, thank you, Jade. I've loved exploring some really interesting topics with you today. And
as I said to you
beforehand, I wasn't entirely sure where we were going to take this. And it's been a lot of fun exploring with you some of those future thinking and the impact of tech on us right now. I think that's really valuable for people. So thank you.
Kia ora. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Beyond Consultation. And what now? Well, I've got three suggestions for you. Firstly, go and check out the show notes in your podcast player or on the Business Lab or Learning Lab website so you can see the resources that were shared in the show. Secondly, send a message to our guests. It's really nice when you've been a guest in this slightly nerve-wracking experience, and then people get in touch to thank you for sharing your stories and experiences. And lastly, do connect with me on LinkedIn. I view LinkedIn as an ongoing conference, you know, this amazing way to be exposed to new people and new ideas that can stretch and enhance your practice. So that's it for today's episode. Thank you again for listening. Ngā mihi mō te whakaroa.